You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's a minute after 10. Coming up in just a minute, we'll have an interview with David Ray Griffin on the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Listening to People Rise Up on your community radio station, KBOO. This is our spring pledge drive, and the more you guys keep the phones ringing during the program, the less we have to interrupt to try and get you to call. So I'll give the numbers once real quick, 503-232-8818, and toll free 877-500-5266. A $75 pledge gets you a copy of the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. My guest this morning is David Ray Griffin, author of said book, as well as The New Pearl Harbor, which I believe is when he last joined us on KBOO. So welcome back to our airwaves, David.
Hi, Andrew. Good to be back with you.
Well, I'm very pleased that you were able to make it. And this book actually was, I guess I got my copy late last fall. It's actually a new book for 2005, and I really wanted to try and get it into our fall pledge drive last year, but only doing two shows, I wasn't able to get to this book, so I'm really glad we can get to it first week of spring 2005. Now, there's so much to talk about in this book that we're not going to even begin to really get into a lot of things in any detail, and I'm interested in talking about more things a little bit less detailed, so we can just give people a broad sweep of what's wrong with the 9/11 Commission report and process. Initially, why don't we talk about something I mentioned in the previous hour, which is hot in the news right now, and that's the issue of the Federal Bureau of Investigation helping Saudis, including members of the bin Laden family, leave the United States in the days immediately following September 11th. How big a revelation is this new information, given that it's been a little bit in the media for a little while?
Yeah, it's really not very new in the sense that the basic facts have been available for at least a year, but what is new is that a mainline publication finally picked it up and reported it and pointed out explicitly that the 9/11 Commission had given a thumbs up for the FBI and for the White House and said that nothing irregular happened. And now we learn that, yes, it did, and the 9/11 Commission was wrong. So it's very important that, at least on one major part of the 9/11 Commission report, the New York Times has now reported that it was wrong.
Seems like there's a lot of that going on. Papers apologizing for not quite doing a proper job of coverage. So again, just a real quick example of, something they just missed. Hard to say.
Yeah, this paper they cite from the Judicial Watch, Craig Unger had reported on this about a year ago, and he first broke this story in his book, House of Bush, House of Saud, and reported that two kinds of irregularities had occurred. First, there had been flights within the United States, private flights carrying Saudis, that were flying before private flights were otherwise allowed to fly. So the implication was that some Saudis had gotten special permission from the White House to fly their people around the country. The second part is the flights out of the country of Saudis, including bin Laden family members who had not been thoroughly investigated. And the story in the New York Times picks up that part and confirms that what Michael Moore then said in his movie, which popularized Craig Unger's views, was right. The New York Times did not pick up the other part of the story, which was that this flight had occurred from Tampa to Lexington prior to the time. Now, the 9/11 Commission report tried to whitewash it by saying, well, that flight occurred on the afternoon of September 13th, and at that time, U.S. airspace had already been opened at 11 o'clock that morning. They deliberately blurred the issue because Craig Unger had explicitly pointed out that 11 o'clock, U.S. airspace was open to commercial flights but not to private flights, and had sent out a special notice saying any private flights will be forced down.
And in fact, there were several private flights that were forced down but sometime between the 13th and when were private flights okay again? Is it the 15th? The 16th?
Well, I think
it's a couple days later.
Yeah, it was certainly not 11 o'clock on the 13th,
right,
in any case. So here again, Craig Unger and Michael Moore were proved right, even though after the movie came out, so many defenders of the administration jumped on this and said this is just obviously false, and the 9/11 Commission had said it was false.
Now, let's back up just a moment and provide some foundation for the discussion of your book. The 9/11 Commission was mandated by Congress, quote, to provide the fullest possible account of the events surrounding 9/11. The Bush administration went to great lengths to try and convince people that the commission was also nonpartisan, because there were Republicans and Democrats. It was independent, because it supposedly was not controlled by the executive office. It was impartial, and it was thorough. Can you just briefly address each of those as you view their report?
Well, the idea that it was impartial is certainly a complete falsification, because the first of all, the chairman is a Republican, Thomas Kane. Now, he's generally considered as fairly moderate Republican, so that was seen okay, and he was supposedly balanced by Lee Hamilton, the vice chairman. But nevertheless, the chairman was Republican, but much more importantly, the executive director was Philip Zelikow. Now, we know that in the first place, the president, when he finally grudgingly had to appoint such a commission, tried to make Henry Kissinger the chair, and there were, howls of outrage about that, and because of all sorts of things. And Kissinger finally resigned rather than reveal his clients, because many people had alleged he had clients that would create a great conflict of interest, that is, clients who were involved in the oil business in Afghanistan. And so Thomas Kane was then selected. We don't know if he was selected on the condition that he would appoint Philip Zelikow, but one can suspect that. Now, the reason Zelikow is so important, and I call it the Kane-Zelikow report, is that Zelikow directed, he was the executive director, and so he was in charge of the staff, and it was the staff, about 80 people, who did all the work, not the commissioners you saw on TV. They just took the results of what the staff had come up with. So Zelikow was in position to determine which leads would be investigated and which ones would not. He was also in position to determine, largely at least, what would go in the final report and what would not. Now, why is this so important? Because Philip Zelikow is virtually a member of the Bush administration. He had been a member of the first Bush administration on the National Security Council with Condoleezza Rice. they became friends. And so during the intervening, during the Clinton years then, they wrote a book together. Then when Bush, too, was elected and appointed Rice his national security advisor, she brought Zelikow on to help with the transition. And then finally he was appointed by Bush to the his foreign intelligence board.
Well, and
so it was almost as if Dick Cheney were in charge of the 9/11 commission that was supposed to be investigating how the White House ran, you know, responded to 9/11.
Well, and not only was Philip Zelikow part of the Bush transition team in 2001, he worked on intelligence matters. And I think it's also important to note that since Condoleezza Rice has been appointed Secretary of State, she has now given Philip Zelikow a job as her counsel.
So, that's right. So the whole idea that this was some sort of non-partial, impartial, independent commission is just is really ridiculous. And as I point out in the book, that's not just a formal complaint, but when you look at the last chapter of the book in the conclusions where I go through and show the implications of this and how he was able to skew things. And furthermore, the other members of the commission, at least half of the staff, were formerly members of the FBI or the Department of Justice or the CIA and other agencies that were supposedly being investigated. Some of these were people who were on duty during the very period that we were supposed to be investigating. So the idea that they were neutral is also not a plausible claim.
David Ray Griffin is our guest. He's the author of the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. And welcome back to our airwaves, David. Now that we've provided just a little bit of context and discussed the issue of the Saudi flights and the FBI just briefly, let's kind of move on, and that's going to be how it goes a little bit this morning, folks, because there's a lot to talk about and only so much time. There's, what is it, 17 chapters here in the book and 16 chapters in the book. The first half or so, maybe two-thirds of the book, deals with kind of general issues around omissions and distortions, whether it's the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings or the Pentagon strike, the Saudi flights, the FBI, the Pakistani intelligence service. And the second half deals pretty much specifically with the response of the U.S. military. And I think we'll focus on the military part in the next segment after the next break. So let's move through some of the first parts of the book. Let's actually skip over the segment about the hijackers, except to point out that the commission could not show any evidence that any of those 19 hijackers we heard so much about were actually on any of those planes. And as you point out in the book, at least six of the supposed hijackers have since been found alive.
Yeah, it's amazing that the commission wouldn't even mention this and say, well, you know, maybe there were some stolen identities or something like this. They just ignored it altogether, put in even the photographs and biographies of the 19 men as if there were no question that these were the actual hijackers, where at least six of them have shown up alive. Some have been interviewed by London newspapers. One walked into a U.S. embassy and announced that he was still alive and so on. So that's a rather gross omission that occurs on the very first pages.
Let's look at the collapse of the World Trade Center buildings, all three of them. Yep, that's right, all three, buildings number one, number two, and number seven. Let's look at buildings number one and two first, because they really fit together, and building seven's its own separate thing. Tell us what, in your opinion, is completely false about how the commission presents the collapse of those two buildings?
Well, the main thing is it doesn't deal with any of the problems with the collapse. It doesn't point out that never before in history have high-rise steel-framed buildings collapsed. And, you know, we just recently had a raging fire in Madrid Mm-hmm. And the fire was going clear through the building, and it burned for many, many hours, and yet it didn't collapse. And yet on 9/11, allegedly, these relatively small fires, particularly small in the South Tower and building number 7, very tiny fires in 7, somehow brought down these three giant buildings. And no explanation of that. Furthermore, there are at least 10 characteristics of controlled demolitions that all of these collapses illustrated. For example, they collapsed very fast in 10 to 15 seconds. They collapsed straight down into their own footprint. There were many other signs of controlled demolitions. The 9/11 report doesn't even mention that as a possible theory.
Well, another really curious thing is that the collapses were total. I mean, these are 100, 110-story buildings. You would think that in a collapse like that, given the design of the building with all these core columns around a center, there would have been pieces of steel sticking up, you know, dozens and possibly even hundreds of feet. I mean, these were almost 1,000 feet tall. And the collapses went down to the ground.
Almost, yeah, nothing more than three stories high. And the commission explicitly endorses the pancake theory, as does this recent little hit piece in Popular Mechanics that endorses the pancake theory. Well, that's the theory that when the planes hit the buildings, they, of course, weakened the floors where they hit, and the idea was then that the floors above them would have collapsed on the floor below them, and then they would have pancaked all the way down, just like the old-fashioned phonograph where the records would collapse. The problem is that in that record collapse, you still had the spindle sticking up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Well, likewise, as you mentioned, the distinctive feature of these buildings, what was distinctive when they were built, was that the core consisted of these 47 really massive steel columns, the very wide at the bottom, and then they tapered off at the top. Well, even if one could plausibly believe that pancake theory would be true and that it could have collapsed at virtually free fall speed, you still would have had those 47 columns sticking about, as you say, 1,000 feet up in the air, and yet they were not.
Well, I mean, let's say that even those 47 columns collapsed 3/4 of the way to the ground. That's still a couple 300 feet.
That's right. That's right. And so how did the 9/11 Commission handle this? It didn't take it on head on. It just implicitly handled it by saying that the core of each tower consisted of a hollow steel shaft. There couldn't be a bigger lie that you could imagine that any report would put out.
Yeah, and yet there are. That was pretty damning. I remember at the time as well that the removal of debris was an urgent feature of the cleanup effort. I don't know how or why, but a lot of the steel beams seemed to break really conveniently in 30-foot lengths, and they happened to fit on these trucks just perfectly to be able to cart them away. I've never heard of that. I've not found anything in my research of structural engineers who could explain why these steel beams, solid steel beams, broke in such a uniform fashion. And nobody can explain why it had to be removed immediately. It's a federal crime to remove evidence from a crime scene.
That's right. Both of those points are very important. The fact that they broke at convenient lengths is one of the 10 characteristics of controlled demolition. In fact, the very company that went in to clean up the mess is called Controlled Demolition Incorporated. And they advertise on their website that's part of their technique, is that they break all the steel in the building at lengths that are ready to load onto trucks. So that's what you had there.
Yeah, it makes sense.
With regard to the removal of the steel, the claim that was made at the time, if you remember, was that there still may be some bodies under there, and so we've got to take all possible steps to save any lives that we might save. And so we have to remove the steel in order to get, you know.
Well,
the problem with that was that building number 7 also collapsed, but according to the official story anyway, everybody had been removed from the building at about noon. It didn't collapse until 5:20 in the afternoon, and so there would have been no bodies there under the rubble, and nevertheless, the steel was removed from building number 7 just as quickly. Now, the 9/11 Commission report handles this incredibly by not even mentioning the building number 7 collapse.
Right. It's like it didn't exist to begin with.
And that was very convenient because everybody admits that as difficult as it is to explain the collapse of the Twin Towers, explain the collapse of the building number 7 is just impossible. FEMA just said, we don't know. And the 9/11 Commission didn't even take it on. It just ignored the whole issue. This is a 47-story building, and it would be, you know, given the fact that the planes hit the towers, one can claim that it was the fire plus the impact of the planes that brought the towers down. That would leave building number 7 as the first building in history to be brought down solely by fire. So that should be an enormous story for insurance companies around the world. The 9/11 Commission doesn't even mention it.
And I can understand the issue of removing debris from on top of potential victims of the collapse who might still be alive, but removal and, you know, safe storage for later examination are two different things. They were, not only was the debris removed from the site, it was put on ships bound for Asia to be recycled. So
that's right. And again, the 9/11 Commission doesn't point this out, doesn't point out, as you did earlier, that generally removal of any piece of evidence whatsoever from a crime scene is a federal offense. This was obviously a crime scene, and yet it was the FBI itself that supervised the removal of evidence.
Right, and then there's the whole issue of jurisdiction. You know, it's like New York City has its own investigative teams, city, borough, county, state, etc. There was not necessarily any reason for the federal government to step in and control things unless the federal government felt like it needed to step in and control things.
That's right, and this happens quite often that the FBI does step in. This is one more example of that, and one more suspicious fact which the 9/11 Commission omits.
I'm speaking with David Ray Griffin. He's the author of the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, as well as, from a couple years back, the new Pearl Harbor, I guess about a year back. So we're back for the final segment here with David Ray Griffin, author of the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions. Welcome back, David.
Glad to be back. I should say I am from Oregon, and so I'm particularly glad to be able to help out your station.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. Now, I wanted to spend this last segment talking about the commission's dealing with the military response, but I got a request from someone who called into the back room to briefly talk about one aspect of the impact at the Pentagon, which we'll sneak in for a minute or two here at the front end. And that has to deal with the fact that nobody could find any parts of a Boeing 757 at the Pentagon. How did the commission address the fact that no plane parts could be found there?
It addressed it in the same way that it addressed most issues. That is, it just ignored the whole thing. It ignored every piece of evidence that suggests that what hit the Pentagon had to be something other than a Boeing 757, and therefore could not have been Flight 77. So So you would think if they had good evidence to refute that, you know, they've heard, they know these theories, and they call them outrageous and by this French crackpot, and, you know, they make all these slams. But here was their chance to present all the evidence against these claims, and they don't take it. So that makes you suspect they don't have any evidence. They do not mention, for example, that they could have easily cleared up the problem by getting the videos. There was a video. There were many videos, of course, all the time, filming anything that would come close to the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
There's one across the street at this regular gas station that the military uses. He reports, the manager there reports that about 5 minutes after the Pentagon crash, the FBI swooped in and took the video, and it's never been seen publicly since.
Well, the
commission could have just subpoenaed it and said, let's show the people. That video would show that what hit the Pentagon was a 757. Of course, they don't do that, and they don't even mention that those videos exist.
Well, and the gas station videotape was not the only one confiscated. I believe there were three, one of which was from a hotel in the area. When the Pentagon did release still frames from a video they said captured the impact at the Pentagon, not only was it virtually impossible to really tell what's going on in terms of something hitting the building, but it was dated September 12th
of 2001. There were so many problems with it. It's just incredible. But if they've got it, why would they release only a few frames from
right.
it? And even some people who were somewhat experts of this looked at the frames and said, oh, they're what made me first suspicious. So it's a very strange little episode.
So let's use our remaining 10 minutes or so here to talk about the military response on 9/11 and how the commission dealt with not only versions 1 and 2 of what the military said happened, but version 3, which they announced to the world at the final 9/11 commission hearing, thereby either committing themselves to have perjured themselves for 3 years, or were now committing perjury by lying before this commission.
Yes, this in some respects is the most incredible thing about the commission report, but it all hinges on this. What they do is create a brand new timeline, almost out of whole cloth, that doesn't conform to any stories that had been coming out in the previous 3 years. So to fill readers, listeners in on what you were talking about, version one is what the Pentagon and NORAD were telling the first couple days after 9/11, which was, no, we didn't send any planes up at all until after the Pentagon was hit. In other words, about an hour and a half had gone by. Well, people were criticizing them, saying, well, gee, your standard
yeah.
operating procedures call for the FAA to notify you whenever there's a possible hijacking, and then you're supposed to scramble planes to intercept them. And normally this process takes 12 to 15 minutes, and yet here 30 or 40 minutes went by, and then an hour and a half, and you didn't do it. So suddenly we get a second story, which came out on September 18th, which served as the official story until the 9/11 report came out. And according to this story, yes, the FAA did notify the military, but the FAA, being composed of bumbling fools, notified it always very late, and so there just wasn't time. The military did scramble the planes. They raced to the targets, but they always got there just a little too late. Well, critics had gone through and looked at those timelines and said, now, just a minute, if the FAA notified you even this late, there was still time for you to have gotten there for the second tower. You should have stopped Flight 175, and you surely should have stopped Flight 77 long before it could have gotten back to Washington. So the commission goes through and changes and creates a new timeline and says, oh, no, that was all wrong. These NORAD officials who came in and testified to these times, they were wrong. Everything they said was incorrect. Here's the truth. with no support whatsoever other than their own word. And according to this third timeline then, they got 9 minutes notification for the first flight, and that wasn't enough because it took 8 minutes for one NORAD official to call another one to get permission to launch airplanes. And then they got absolutely no notification whatsoever of the other three flights until after they had crashed. And so the second half of my book goes through that in great detail and shows how each of their changes contradicts not only dozens of newspaper accounts that had been given in the meantime, but many eyewitness testimonies.
Now, a related issue to the military response is the issue of the phone bridges, which are basically just video conferences. You know, they're conference calls, but video that...
some of them are video conferences. Some of them were just telephone conferences.
Okay.
But in either case, conversations were going on. And, yes, this is another very important thing, because what the military had to claim then to the 9/11 Commission was that, look, we didn't know anything about these other flights, so how could have we intercepted them? Of course, that ignores the whole fact that the Secret Service knows everything that's going on from the FAA, also that the military has a radar that is far superior to the FAA's radar, so they're not dependent on the FAA. Once they have any inkling there's a crisis, they would know more than the FAA would. But in any case, ignoring that, they claim then that they couldn't have learned anything from these teleconferences from the FAA, because for various reasons, and one main point is they just got started too late. And here is where you have extreme contradictions. For example, the FAA, it's standard procedure for the FAA to initiate a conference whenever there's any kind of problem like this going on of possibly hijacked airliners. Now, Laura Brown, the communications person at the FAA, has said the FAA teleconference started at about 8:50, just a few minutes after the first tower had been hit. The 9/11 Commission report says the FAA teleconference didn't begin until 9:20. In other words, they put it 30 minutes later in order to be able to claim that they could not have possibly learned about Flight 175 from that teleconference. Likewise, the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon itself evidently started its own teleconference, and the guy who was put in charge of that, he will not say when it started. He says, oh, I can't remember, which is incredible. This was the biggest day in his life. Laura Brown first testified that it started at 8:20 after her superiors refreshed her memory. You know what that means. She modified that till 8:45, but still, Tom Flacco has said that a source at the Department of Transportation said Laura Brown's first figure was right, 8:20. A high NORAD official said it started earlier. Richard Clark's book has it starting at about 9:15, but nevertheless, the 9/11 Commission report says it didn't really start until much later than that, not at least until 9:29 or 9:30.
Given that we got about a minute or so left here, I don't really want to kind of try and dive in and ask more about this.
Let me give one more example then.
Please, yeah.
The Cheney affair, which is the other most outrageous thing in the because everybody knows that Cheney was in charge, and he's the one who gave the shoot-down order. The question then is, what about all the evidence that the military actually shot down Flight 93 that crashed in Pennsylvania?
Right.
The commission goes to great lengths to try to make that rule that out. So whereas everybody else, including Norman Mineta, who was Secretary of Transportation and was there in the underground bunker with Cheney, says that Cheney was there by 9:20 or earlier, the 9/11 Commission report says, oh, no, he didn't get there till 35 minutes later, almost 10 o'clock, and then he didn't give the shoot-down order until 10 or 10:15, in other words, after Flight 93, whereas Richard Clark, in Against All Enemies, says that the shoot-down order was given maybe about 9:45, and therefore in plenty of time to have shot down Flight 93.
Well, and it also contradicts Norman Mineta's testimony before the commission on May 23rd of 2003, which I referenced nearly a couple hours ago, regarding, you know, his timing and when an order was given. It doesn't say shoot down order. It regards the approaching plane to Washington and a guy asking, you know, as the plane approaches, do the orders still stand, asking Vice President Cheney. It's only assumed that it's a shoot-down order of the plane, but there's evidence.
Yeah, this evidently was related to whatever it was that was about to hit the Pentagon, and whereas the 9/11 Commission report says that they didn't learn about it until 9:36 and therefore didn't have time to react, Mineta's testimony says that they knew about it certainly by 9:25. And so in both cases, the 9/11 Commission report simply omits Mineta's testimony, which is clearly outrageous, but that shows the power of Philip Zelikow as executive director. He just deleted, could delete anything that didn't fit the official account.
I've been speaking this morning with David Ray Griffin. He is the author of the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, and previously, in the same vein, The New Pearl Harbor. Thank you very much for joining us this morning, David.
You're welcome, Andrew. Thank you.